Thank you very kindly, Pete. I am greatly honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me to speak here at the church as well. I'm very glad to be here. My background is in orchestral conducting and not in speaking, but God has given me a lot of opportunities to speak about music to folks around the country and even overseas, and so it's a great joy to me because it's a gift that He's given when exercised. When your gift is given and exercised, isn't it a great joy to do? It really is a delight for me to be able to speak to you. I want to talk very briefly about Johann Sebastian Bach. He's a somewhat famous composer, I suppose. Many people think, even unbelievers think, that he's the greatest composer that ever lived, and I think they're right. I think it's true. He's an amazing, amazing fellow. Just a little biographical background, and then what I want to do is play for you a bit of music of his and compare it to some music of another composer so that you can kind of get a fix on what exactly he was doing in this piece and draw from that some conclusions about how he viewed the world and how he applied his Christian faith, because Bach in every way was a very strong and solid believer. He was born in 1685 and died in 1750. And we even mark the end of the Baroque period in music at 1750, simply because that's when he died. When he died, it was over with, not beforehand. But by the end of the time he died, the Baroque period for everybody else had already long since gone. So in a sense, he was the last of the line of great Baroque composers. You know of other Baroque composers like Corelli and Vivaldi and Telemann and George Frederick Handel. Bach was the last of those, and a contemporary of Handel's, but still the last of those and the greatest of those. And he sort of took everything that everybody else did and did it better. He just knew how to sort of absorb the best from everybody who had gone before and then show how it could be done the very best. So he was a bit of a dinosaur, though, by the time he died, though, because his own children had already gone into what they called the new style, which was Rococo period music. So Bach was still, and he had actually encouraged them to do that, too, by the way. That wasn't a concern for him. But by the time he died, he was the only guy still writing in this old Baroque style. He worked as an organist, as a choir director, and as a composer all of his life. He was born into a very famous and talented musical family, so he inherited a lot of musical gifts that way. So it wasn't too surprising that he went into those fields. But that's what he did. He worked at those three things all of his life. He wrote cantatas, passions, a mass. He wrote all sorts of orchestral works for large and small ensembles of instruments, concertos for many instruments, works for keyboard, for clavier, and for harpsichord, and especially for the organ. He wrote solo works for all sorts of instruments, violin, cello, and so on. But I remember having a music history teacher tell me that he wrote so much music in his life that some wag had decided to divide it all down into how many bars of music he wrote per day in his life, a sort of average, you know, per day. And it was some astronomical figure, you know, like 89 bars of music every day of his life. And this is this little German man that was my music history teacher in grad school. And he said it like this. He said, "You know that Bach wrote more than 80 bars of music every day of his life. And during the first few months of his life, he hardly wrote anything at all." But it's true, though. He wrote so much music, it's hard to imagine that any one person could have composed as much as he did. In fact, it was so much music, and he wrote so many things that were even lost. But he wrote a different cantata, for example, for every Sunday of the year, 5 years running. He had five different cantatas for every single, and two of those years we've lost. We only have about 3 years worth of them. And where did they go? Well, they were on manuscript paper. You know, he wrote them all out by hand. All by quill pen or something. And they were lost. They were left in, you know, rehearsal rooms, or they were left in attics somewhere. And after Bach died, his own wife went to the fish market one time, the story goes, and received her fish, you know, bought this fish, and as she took it home and unwrapped it, it was wrapped in one of his manuscripts. They were that pervasive. They were just everywhere. People just had them, used them as newspapers, kind of. It was that much stuff. Well, the funny thing is, during his lifetime, he was almost unknown as a composer. Isn't that strange? After having written all that music. Now, his church knew. The people around his church knew. But he was famous for something altogether different. Did you know what it was? Not for his composition.
Improvisation.
Oh, improvisation on the organ. That's right. He was an astounding organ player. And a great improviser, exactly right. He really was a virtuoso, and everybody came from miles around to hear him play. I'll tell you one quick story about what it was like back there. I'm doing research for another talk on Bach one time. I came across some letters that went between Bach and his pastor, and the pastor was asking him, because he had written a cantata for every Sunday of the year, could you write your cantatas, I think it was 5 minutes shorter or 10 minutes shorter or something like that. They're a little too long, he said. And the reason was, and Bach was happy to do it too, because the reason was the church services were going too long in the wintertime. He just wanted them shorter in the wintertime, not in the summertime, because there was no heat in the church and people were getting too cold. And I thought, well, gee, I wonder how long they had to stay in there. And I read on, and it turns out everybody understood that what they were trying to do was knock back the service length time from 4.5 hours to 4 hours. So they were taking 5 minutes here and 10 minutes there and so on. The one thing he wasn't going to change, the pastor said, was the length of his sermon, which was 1 hour long every Sunday. And it was read. It was written out and read. And Bach asked for the permission to be able to take his choir out of the choir loft and take them back into the school next door so that they could be warm during the sermon, so they wouldn't have to sit in the cold church during the sermon. And the pastor agreed to that as long as they had copies of the sermon to read where they were. Isn't that amazing? Well, one of the things I said during the week here was that there is a difference in sort of Greek aesthetic principles between two gods, Apollo and Dionysus. Apollo being the god of reason and contemplation, Dionysus being the god of, these are Greek gods, you understand, not real gods, but this is the mythology of the Greeks. Dionysus was the god sort of experience and emotions and so on. And you find music that follows sort of after the worship of both of those guys. One, music was composed by some composers in the Renaissance period, for example, that held as a highest authority in beauty that sort of Apollonian picture that was, so the music was very balanced and orderly and rarefied and contemplative and peaceful, you know? And then music that was written for the Dionysian worship implied or inspired music that was more emotional. It was meant to be of the moment and of the feelings and of the emotions. And much of the music of the Baroque period reflected some of those sorts of thinking, that sort of thinking. Well, what I wanted to do was play for you some examples from Bach's magnificent work, the B minor Mass, the Mass in B minor. But in order to get it into context, I thought I would show you, because it's a piece that's the height of Baroque thinking. I thought I'd show you a piece that was the height of Renaissance thinking so you could hear the same text set by two different composers in two different styles. So you understand something about what they're doing. Giovanni Luigi di Palestrina is a composer who lived at the end of the 16th century, and he wrote a Mass. The Mass texts from the Roman Catholic Church were set by all these various composers all through the ages. So they're very old. In fact, part of the Mass text is the very creed that we read today, that they called the Credo in Latin, but the Creed, the Nicene Creed. And I'm actually going to play you a couple of spots from that very Nicene Creed, how Bach set that. But the first thing I wanted to show you was a movement from Palestrina, from the Renaissance, to compare with. And it's the Gloria movement. Do you remember the text, Gloria in excelsis Deo? We still sing it in some of our Christmas carols and so on. Do you know where it comes from? Gloria in excelsis Deo et in terra pax dominibus bone voluntatis. Does that ring a bell? Matthew 5, right. Yeah, the Latin version, exactly right. Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace on those on whom his favor rests. It's a kind of awkward translation, but that's kind of what it means. Bone voluntatis. Well, listen for a second to how it is that Palestrina took that text and set it to music. Let me play that one once more for them after I discuss it, Joe. Okay? Leave that one in, would you? We'll play that one more time. Can you hear what's going on in there? First of all, you notice there are no instruments. It's all what they call in the chapel style, a cappella, which is what that means. No instruments is what it technically means in the style of the chapel. That's how they sang things. Well, also you notice that every voice that comes in very plainly, very clearly, and moves in sort of gentle, stepwise fashion. La-da-dee-dee-da-da-dee-da-dee-da-da-da, with the opening chant borrowed from the old ancient church chants from the Middle Ages. And then they sing Gloria in excelsis Deo straight through, almost one syllable per word, note. So there's no what they call melismas. They don't go, Gloria, or something like we do in our hymn. What's the hymn? Gloria. You see that, right? Well, that's this sort of melismatic, what they call melismatic singing. This is what they call syllabic singing. You sing one syllable per note. So it's very straightforward and clear. You also notice you hear all the parts very clearly, right? And also, it's very balanced and sort of reserved and controlled and radiant, gentle, sort of otherworldly almost, right? There's no beat to it, doesn't make your heart pump faster. It's all supposed to be airy and clear and open and for contemplation. Play it one more time, listen to just a second or two of it again, and then I'll play you what Bach did, setting that same text. The second cut of that B minor mass disc, and listen to how it is that Bach, 150 years later, sets that same text. gives you a little idea. What's the difference? What do you hear different? Instruments, right off the bat, right? Immediately. What kind of instruments? What's the first one that struck your ear? Horns, trumpet. Yeah, trumpet, timpani. I'm a trumpet player. It's celebrative. It's bright and it's emotional suddenly, don't you think? It gives you a little thrill, kind of. What do the words mean? Glory to God in the highest. Isn't it a moment of great rejoicing? The great happiness? Yeah. The angels suddenly appear to the shepherds and they sing glory to God in the highest. Have you ever wondered what that sounded like? Well, I think Bach wondered what that sounded like. The difference is the Palestrina example is a good example of the mindset that says the music itself has to be beautiful in and of itself, in the sense that it has to be balanced in that sort of Apollonian way I was talking about, balanced and orderly and calling you to things above, sort of Platonic ideals for all of you philosophers. All that stuff is involved in that way, the way they wrote music in the end of the 16th century in Italy. In the Baroque period, it's just the opposite, in a sense, in that the words actually dictate to the music what the music ought to sound like. The meaning of the words leads. For the Apollonian view, the music itself has to be perfect, and then you just lay the words in there. You see, the music comes first, and then the words. For the Baroque period, they want to have the music reflect the words. They want to express the words with the music. You remember Handel's Messiah? Do you know the tenor aria from Handel's Messiah, the first one? Every valley shall be exalted. Do you remember that? It goes, let's see if I can do this in the morning. Every valley, do you remember that one? Every valley shall be exalted. And then it goes, shall be exalted. Like that, right? Well, what does exalted mean anyway? To be lifted up, right? See, it's being lifted up, see? That's what Handel was trying to get across. The crooked straight, the crooked straight, and the rough place is plain, you see? If you listen to Handel's Messiah again, listen carefully, because all through it he writes what we call tone painting, where he makes the music reflect the nature of the words. Well, that's what Bach is doing here too. Bum 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 ti ta 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 bum 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 ta 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 ti ta 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 ti bum ta ti ta 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 ta. It's a dance. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. Like a waltz. 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Minuet or something. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. It's kind of a fast minuet. 1, 2, 3, 1. That's what he was after. Suddenly the music is not just ethereal and otherworldly, which is marvelous. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say one is good and the other is bad. But I think Bach actually incorporates more of both. It speaks of the transcendent, but it speaks of the transcendent in music that's actually physical too. It makes you want to tap your foot a little, you know. The joy of it is not just an intellectual joy, it's a joy that reaches to your emotions too. That's what he was after. He wanted the piece to actually click with you that way. The audience in Bach's music always participates in the thing that way. The intention is for him to get you to feel the way he felt when he read the text. So that's how he approaches the Gloria movement. Let's take a look at a couple of short segments of the Credo. You know, in the Credo, in the second part of the Creed, we speak about Jesus and at one point say he was incarnated by the Holy Spirit of the Virgin Mary. Right? You remember that part? Well, the Latin for that is et incarnatus est ex Maria Virgini. The Holy Spirit first, and then of the Virgin Mary. But listen to what the music sounds like when he sets the idea of et incarnatus and incarnated est was. Turn it up just a little bit. You see what he's doing? He's taking this unbelievably mysterious thing. Any conception is in a mystery, right? If you think about it. Growing corn turns out to be a mystery. You know, we don't really know how it happens. We put the corn seed in the ground and we cover it up and we water it, but we can't make it do anything. God brings it to happen. So every birth is a mystery, but this one especially, right? So he shrouds it all in a sort of mysterious hovering cloud of harmony, and he has the melodies descend. The right use of the word condescension is what the incarnation is. Isn't that right? That's the theological word. He condescended to be with us. And then just brushes the word ex Maria Virgini, the most unbelievably gentle, statement of that part. Can you imagine, though? I mean, here we've just read the Nicene Creed, and I'm all for reading it, so don't get me wrong. This isn't a knock, but we don't think of it that way, do we? When we read it, it's a sort of statement. But wouldn't it be wonderful if we had this in our heads, too, as a means of sort of fleshing out the understanding of the experience even of what these words mean. Bach took those words that everybody had said for a millennia before him, more than that, and ever since the council in 325, I guess, and put them into a sort of emotional experience almost. And I think that he brings it all to life. He makes it sort of dramatic almost. The Baroque period is a very dramatic period. Dionysus was, by the way, the god of the theater. That's where theater came from. It's from Dionysian temple worship way back in the Greeks. to begin with. Now, the church, as it did with so many other things, stepped in and sort of redeemed it and made use of it in the early Middle Ages and so on. Okay, one other example from this same piece. Let's go on a little further in the creed, where we're told that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate for us, died and was buried. The Latin is crucifixus sub Pontio Pilato, passus died et sepultus est, and was put in a sepulcher, was buried, in other words. Listen to how he sets this. Well, just before I play it, hang on one second, Joe. Before I play it, I want you to hear the pain, the harmonic pain of it, when they sing crucifixus on the syllable fixus. It always comes on the downbeat. Crucifixus, crucifixus, like that always. And on the word fix, on the syllable fix, there's this tension, harmonic tension, that's released more somewhat on the word us. So crucifixus, like that always. So there's a certain sort of pain involved. Not only the pain of being physically crucified, but the pain of the people who are watching it, seeing their beloved Lord and Son even dying. So it's a very painful moment. But Bach brings that out for us, so that we, in a sense, participate emotionally in that pain too. So we're watching the crucifixion. Hear the instruments at the very beginning? You can just take it out. I'm going to get you started again. The instruments at the very beginning have a bass line that's run, the cello and the bass and the organ. Bum 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 bum. And then it goes over again. Bum 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 bum. And you would think that'd be very dull and boring, but and he does that over and over again throughout the thing. You'd think that would be dull and boring, but the fact is he changes the upper part every time it comes. So the strings are playing something different, flute playing different, or especially the singers are singing different lines and interacting in different ways. So it's got this unifying bass line that's very much like, it's actually too fast. This performance is a little too fast for me. It ought to be pom 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 pom. So I brought the wrong recording, I guess. But the thing is, it's a little like a heartbeat going on. Well, above that, apart from the singers, are some flutes and violins playing. And they play these longer notes, half notes, above it. Thum, thum, bing, bong, like that. And they give a kind of a radiant color to the orchestra in the background. And what's wonderful is, the last time through, the last time at the end of the movement, when they sing Passus et Sepultus Est, the last time, those violins and flutes are taken out, and all you're left with is that bass line, boom, 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 and so on. And it's as though the radiance of the piece disappears, and it's just left with that sort of heartbeat. The thing kind of collapses down. There's no hazy light around the thing anymore. Some critics actually say this is like a halo of around Jesus, these violins and flutes. And when they disappear, it's as though he's dying. His life is ebbing away. And the last time through, I don't know whether they do it on this or not, but they should get a little bit slower. And that pulse is like the last time you're going to hear his heart beating. But then I'm going to let it play right into the next movement. Because if you know the Nicene Creed, crucified for us under Pontius Pilate, died and was buried. And then the next, not on the third day he rose, but rose on the third day. So the word is et resurrexit tertia die, secundum scripturas, according to the scriptures. And it's really powerful if you think about the difference between dying and resurrecting. Bach, sure enough, thinks that's very important. And so he plays through this crucifixion and has Jesus actually go down to the grave in the music, and then listen to what he does with the next part of the text at resurrection. Let's start that one cut one more time, would you, Joe? Thank you. This is not very long, so I'll play you the whole thing.
Thank you.
how the end, that's the end of that one long phrase. You notice too that they're doing all these melismas. It's Rezul, da 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 da, all this stuff, right? Well, it's almost like it's bubbling out of them. You can't keep it in. You can't just say, et resurrexi tertia die secundus gru. You can't do that. You got to go, et resurrexi, you know? Well, and now you understand that you have to understand that in context of the music that came before that period, that's pretty expressive. If you think about it compared to a lot of the music today, well, it's pretty tame, I guess. But for them, that was really very expressive. So gives a great thrill to the people. It's a sort of emotional, almost physical response to what the words actually mean. So that's what he's about. Well, there's no way I can play you all the music from the piece. It's a quite long work. But I hope that this little taste has encouraged you to go and listen to the whole thing. Because this work, this Bach B minor Mass, is one of the pieces that I think, if you want to be an educated person in the culture of the Western world, this is one of the pieces you have to hear. You have to know this work. It's like knowing the Shakespeare plays. It's like knowing the Rembrandt paintings. It's this piece by this composer is the pinnacle of a great deal of what has happened in the Western world. Let me close with three reasons why Johann Sebastian Bach is my hero. How's that? First of all, in Bach's mind, there was no split between the sacred and the secular, as there is today in many of our minds. He understood that you could glorify God in all that you did in all of your life, everywhere, no matter what. He was famous for signing the ends of his compositions with the letters SDG, which stood for Soli Deo Gloria, to God alone be glory, for this piece. But the curious thing is, he signed that to pieces that were written for the church and pieces that were written to celebrate the most recent governor's election or something. You know, there was no division in his mind that what he was doing was for the glory of God, whether it was done for the worship service or whether it was done for the Margrave of Brandenburg on his election or his installation as Margrave. So that kind of thing wasn't a problem for him. In fact, Bach quite rightly opposed a strange occurrence in his lifetime. I read some letters where he stood against this. In his lifetime, toward the end of his life, the University of Berlin decided to separate the theology department and the philosophy departments from each other. The philosophy department in the University of Berlin had been arguing for many years that it couldn't follow all the ins and outs of its own discipline because theology was giving it too much limitation, they thought. They were restricting it, you see. And so eventually that tension finally broke and the two were separated and put into different departments free to run their own areas. But up until then, all through the Middle Ages and up until then at the University of Berlin, the theology department had authority over what was studied in nearly every other subject. But especially philosophy chafed under that weight. And it was a terrible thing, actually. It was a terrible thing. And you can argue, if I had another hour, I would give you a history of the university that shows how we came to an elective system today where it doesn't make any difference what you study. You know, you can go in there and just pick and choose whatever you want to study in today's universities. Back then, they had a very specific course of action that you needed to take with theology at the core of everything that you studied in the Middle Ages. Well, anyway, that's another lecture. But the point is, Bach, when he heard that, knew what a danger it was because it began to bifurcate or split up the world view of the people. You could learn about God, you could learn about truth, rather, by way of theology or by way of philosophy. Can't have that bifurcation. So I'm proud of him for standing against that. He didn't succeed, but he stood against it. Second thing, he wrote for his people. His colleague, or his contemporary, George Frederick Handel, of course, who wrote Messiah, was actually internationally famous. He was famous in England, really, not for his oratorios, but for his operas. Did you know that? Handel was an opera composer. And in fact, one of my old history teachers used to say, George Frederick Handel was a German composer who wrote Italian operas in England. And that's right. That's exactly right. He was a cosmopolitan kind of guy, very famous with a lot of people. The other day we had a 4th of July celebration in Memphis, and the Memphis Symphony played, and they had fireworks and so on, outdoor concert, you know. But they chose, one of the pieces they chose to play was the Royal Fireworks music by Handel. And I thought that was a really bad idea, you see, because that was written for the King of England. Didn't seem to fit at all with a celebration of our independence. But see, they missed that. They went for the word fireworks, see. I was the only one that was troubled by that. Nobody else seemed to be bothered by it. Anyway, Bach, however, was known only in his community, and he spent his entire life writing music for his congregations to sing, for his performers in his musicians in his churches to perform, and the way he went through his life was when he was in one church that had a great organ, he would write organ pieces. He went to another church that had a great chorus, so he would write pieces for choir. Or another church, he had a little ensemble, orchestral ensemble, so he wrote for them. So when you find the great choral works from a particular period, it's not by mistake, it was that he was actually writing for the people that he had. Isn't that interesting? He wasn't sort of aggrandizing his music and saying, well, someday somebody will play it right. No, he wrote for the people that he had. And so there was a community that was formed partly by the compositions that they had in common. I think that's a marvelous thing and something, a vision that churches ought to take up again. And we ought to see more and more compositions, new compositions being written just for your own community. Find in your community where you have some composers and set them to work writing music that the congregation can sing for text, that you want the congregation to learn and delight in and offer up as worship. And find a way to make those things your own. Then you're not just singing the things guys write in Nashville or things that guys written many centuries ago, but you're writing your own music. It's a marvelous thing, and that's what he did. The third thing I think he's really great about is that he himself, while he was a Lutheran all of his life, he had great sympathy for the other big sort of religious movement of the time, what they called the Pietists, that were more Calvinists, I guess. And he loved his Lutheran liturgy, and he loved his Lutheran church and so on. And he stuck with that all of his life. But at the same time, he always had great sympathy for what was good about the Pietists. In particular, their personalized faith, their appreciation of the intimacy of the Lord with individual souls and so on. And many of the things that the Pietists held, he valued too. And in his music, I think he often reflects both an appreciation for a sort of church calendar, liturgical, Lutheran polity or worship style, if you will. And at the same time, he appreciates and applies a personalized faith that I think he got far more from the Pietists than he did from the Lutherans. And all of this individual response, all of this individual emotional contact with the texts that he's put into his music in the worship service, I think came out of that love of Pietism. So it behooves us, I think, to imitate him in many ways, including finding what's good about those who are in other denominations, if you will. You know what I mean? Keeping to what's right, keeping to what's good here, but recognizing those who are also brothers and sisters in other places that maybe don't agree with us exactly on soteriology or exactly on this or that or the other thing, who love the Lord, can be praised for what is good about what they're doing. It brings unity to the body, and I'm all in favor of that, and I think Bach understood that too. So, there's my talk on Bach. If you'd like to stay and ask some questions, I'd be glad to meet you here or in the back. Thank you all very much. And thank you, Pete.
A couple of announcements. They need to meet you outside.